Good morning, Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. Excited to be here with you this wonderful Wednesday morning, April 16th, the day after tax day over here. Hopefully you guys got all that filed, all that goodness done over there. I know for my tax service professional friends over here, this is a big drinking day for these guys right here, a holiday, right? I can't get an email or a text back from any of my friends in that business from about March, say 5th or so to like April 16th, like right here that day. So here's to raise a glass for all those working hard in that industry, because they've got two peak days over here, right? That April 15th date and of course the October 15th date, which is one that rings a little truer to my heart as a guy that always has to file an extension every single year with a pretty complicated tax return as a restaurateur, as you might imagine. Now that tax season has ended over here in the Old Pueblo, we're getting a little bit more action on political season than you may have expected, right? You might have thought of this as sort of an off year with just a few city council elections over here, but suddenly we're having some pretty substantive changes in Southern Arizona. And it all stems, of course, from the passing of Raul Grijalva and the trickle effect that is working its way down, not just from the congressional race, but into the Board of Supervisors, and ultimately even into our current city council right now. Yesterday, at a special meeting, the Pima County Board of Supervisors announced that Andres Cano has been appointed as supervisor, a Pima County supervisor, to replace the seat of Adelitra Grijalva. And if you didn't notice, quietly, that was the sound of the Pima County Board of Supervisors moving just a little further to the left.
Just a bit.
Now, you may be shocked by this one to say that Adelitra Grijalva was perhaps the moderate on the Pima County Board of Supervisors, but looking at what we have in the makeup over there, it might really be true. At this point, Jen Allen has been appointed vice chair, right? Rex Scott is the chair. Jen Allen, with only 2 months of experience in government, is now sitting as the vice chair of the Pima County Board of Supervisors. Pretty much the second most powerful person in the entire county is somebody that was a social activist and has 60 days of government experience. And Andres Cano, who was appointed to this position, at least does have some government experience behind him. He was a state legislator, if you remember. And most recently has been working as a liaison, as a consultant between the House and the city of Tucson, almost as a lobbyist of sorts. And rumor on the street says even the $95,000 a year salary that makes up the Board of Supervisors is actually a pay cut for Mr. Cano. I don't know that to be a fact, but I've heard that from a couple different sources over here. And so, welcome Andres Cano to the Board of Supervisors. A 3-0 vote. Steve Christie was absent from that particular meeting. But either way, the supervisors had to appoint another Democrat. Not that that was going to be shocking in any capacity, but certainly something to keep an eye on as the makeup of our board now has, you know, Jen Allen, Matt Hines, Rex Scott, right? Like Andres Cano, and of course, Steve Christie. And so we're moving just a little further left of center and the Board of Supervisors, and that's going to make a big difference on things. Now, Mr. Cano does not get to ride out the next 3.5 years of Adelita's seat. There's going to be a special election in 2026. No word on whether or not he's going to run for that particular seat. Most recently, the City Council and the Board of Supervisors have taken this position of appointing people who weren't going to run in the subsequent elections. However, that's not statutorily like required by law, just sort of a de facto practice that they've been doing. And I have a feeling that Mr. Cano, with his political experience, will, in fact, be a candidate in 2026 as well.
Yeah, Grant, it is funny. They didn't put that litmus test that they put on a lot of many recent appointments about, do you promise not to run for seek the office?
Without a doubt. And that's something to be said with you know, how they're going to move forward with this one and what's going to happen as well, too, with the city of Tucson. Because this week, since our last show over here, Richard Fimbres has announced that he is going to be retiring as of May 1st from the city council. And as such, even though there's going to be an election coming up later this year for that Ward 5 seat, as such, they have to announce an appointment to fill that position. And it's looking like they're going to figure out those processes on their next upcoming meeting this Tuesday, April 22nd. And according to Mayor Romero, they're looking at having that appointment nominated on their subsequent meeting, which would be Tuesday, May 6th, the day after Cinco de Mayo over here. And so we're going to end up with another city council person who very clearly is going to be somebody that they picked that is not running in this race right now. There happens to be four Democrat candidates running in that particular race as we speak. There were six, but a couple of them didn't get their signatures in, and so we're down to four at this point, all of which have expressed some interest in the seat, but nearly unanimously all of the city council has suggested that they are not going to put their thumb on the scale, as they might say, give the gift of incumbency to one of these candidates over here and help them out in that processes. So it'll be interesting to see who is this short-term solution to fill that particular seat of Mr. Fimbres, a long time city council person. He's been in that seat since 2009, a 32-year veteran of the police force. And so thank you, Mr. Fimbres, for your service. And he as well was a relatively moderate Democrat candidate. And if we're not careful, you're going to see the city council take another step to the left as well, too. You're likely to see it with this appointment right now. And it will be interesting to see how this ward shakes out. There happens to be no Republican candidate filed enough signatures to end up running for Ward 5. So the winner of the Democrat primary in that particular seat is going to be our Ward 5 city council person. Guaranteed 100%. You have heard it here first. On top of that, there's all the candidates are now set for CD7. The announcement that Adelidra Grijalva was going to leave her particular seat now has, like, her leaving, you know, the city, the Board of Supervisors, and is now officially running for CD7. Republicans and Democrats have lined up for this particular special election, which is going to occur off cycle, as we discussed on last week's show as well, too. Kind of a bummer, given that we already have elections either way coming up, that we couldn't have just timed that another week or two and saved, like, what does a special election cost again, Matt?
$1 million.
Exactly. $1 million.
That was the dialogue last time.
Yes, we could have saved a few bucks over here.
Bill 414 million dollars.
Yes, I believe it was $1.1 million. And so we could have saved a seven-figure sum by having those ones line up. But that's nobody's fault. That happens to just be statute based on the passing of Mr. Grijalva and how these things lined up. But either way, there's a fair bit of a fight for this particular seat on the Democrat side, and three Republicans submitted enough signatures to get there as well, too. Notably, Daniel Gutierrez, who ran last time against Mr. Grijalva, and Jorge Rivas, a restaurateur, right? Sammy's Mexican Grill on North Oracle Road has also announced his intentions to run over there as well, too. We've done a couple events with Jorge over at St. Philip's Plaza before in the past. But either way, those candidates face a tremendous, tremendous uphill battle because of the voter registration in CD7. I don't want to say that it's a done deal, but that would be an incredibly challenging race for somebody to come out and win. On top of that, on other things that you need to know, the U of A, as I discussed last week, had to quickly hire a women's basketball coach and replace Adia Barnes, who left for the greener pastures and perhaps more money of SMU, just outside of Dallas over here. Miss Barnes was making $1.3 million a year. And when Tommy Lloyd was hired, he was making about $2.5 million a year. So there wasn't a tremendous gap in salaries between the men's and women's coach at that point. However, at that fork in the road over these last 2 years, we've taken a tremendous turn. Now Ms. Burke was hired for $675,000 a year, and Tommy Lloyd has recently renegotiated his salary, making upwards of $5 million a year. And so that delta between the men's and women's coach probably couldn't be any stronger. And while I appreciate and respect women's sports, I've got a pair of daughters who I absolutely want to succeed in life and have zero glass ceilings, I do think that ultimately these are different animals. In the same way that the head chef at the local Applebee's doesn't make exactly what the head chef of the Ventana Room makes, right? They're both chefs. They're both preparing food. They're both doing schedules. They're both kitchen managers. they're not really doing the same job. They may both be serving food, but they are entirely, entirely different animals. And it's safe to say that that is the case here with men's and women's basketball as we start the Becky Burke era. She's got a lot of pieces to pick up over here as there's been a tremendous amount of student athletes entering their name in the transfer portal and leaving our University of Arizona program. Now, when we talk about restaurant analogies into politics, I always bring this up a lot on this show because you happen to be, when you're in the restaurant business, of a business that's so heavily governed with so much regulatory oversight that whether you like it or not, whether you think you're in the business of pasta or you think you're in the business of steak, you, my friend, are in the business of government. And I love seeing restaurateurs such as Jorge Rivas taking a stab at a congressional seat, a guy that has signed the front side of a paycheck and knows a few things about balancing a budget. And when we come back after the break, we're going to bring on another political candidate with a fair bit of restaurant history over here in the old Pueblo. He's taking a stab at the Ward 6 City Council election. We're going to have former PJ's Subs owner and current Ward 6 City Council candidate, Mr. Jay Tolkoff, coming up after the break. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Krueger on 1030 AM, The Morning Voice, your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Krueger. Always happy to be with you here on Wednesday morning, 7 to 9 a.m. on 1030 a.m. KVOI. And we are joined live right now in the KVOI studios by Mr. Jay Tolkoff, former restaurateur and current candidate for City Council Ward 6. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning, Grant. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks so much for joining us over here in the KVOI studios. Happy to have a chat with you.
Well, it's nice to be here. A little early for me, but in the restaurant world, that is not unusual.
Hey, we're up late and up early as far as it goes in the restaurant business. A fair bit of caffeine over here happening in Bustos Media to keep us all going and moving forward. But I wanted to break down your history and introduce you to some of our listeners over here that may not know you from PJ Subs. But give us a rundown of Jake Tolkoff. Where are you from?
Well, I grew up in New Jersey. Lived there for 20 years, and the beginning of my life there pretty much was playing music. I was a professional musician, had my first paying gig when I was 12 years old, and I really chased that dream for a long time. And by the time I got to be about 20 years old, I realized that there were tons of people a lot better than I was, and they were starving to death. And my other passion was electrical stuff. I built my first amplifier and things of that nature, and that led me to go to school for electrical engineering. And when I was 20 years old, decided I wasn't going to be the next John Lennon, I decided to move out to Arizona to finish my degree at the University of Arizona. Was going to be a two-year stint, and got here and said, wow, this place is great, and wound up making it my life. I've been here almost 50 years now. Real strange turn of events. I was working in the music industry. I worked at what's now Centennial Hall as a theater assistant for a whopping $2.12 an hour.
Minimum wage has changed slightly since then, sir.
Well, the state is exempt from paying minimum wage. I was making less than minimum wage. And I was the handyman at my apartment complex to offset my rent, which was, I think it was about $70 a month. We had a two-bedroom apartment with five of us shared. And in between my junior and senior year, I had the unfortunate collision with another car or a couple cars and wound up getting my right arm crushed.
Oh, my.
And after being in the hospital for a week, got back to my apartment not knowing how I was going to pay my rent because my job was very physical and I had a lot of steel and screws in my arm. And my roommate ordered a pizza from a new place in town called Domino's Pizza. And I had a $100 van, and I thought, gee, I could deliver pizzas and be able to make my rent in September. So I actually asked the delivery guy, who turned out to be the franchisee, if they were looking for people for fall sessions. And he said, yeah, come on down and fill out an application. I did, and I started 1979, August 6th, as the fourth employee of Domino's Pizza in the state of Arizona as a driver. And I was, I put myself through school, and I really liked working there. It was fun. And as it turns out, they were getting ready to open up another store, and they kind of recruited me to be the next store manager for Domino's. And I thought, oh, come on, I'm a senior in electrical engineering. Why would I want to make pizzas for a living? And then I started thinking to myself, you know, it might not be bad. Maybe I'll go ahead and go to work as a store manager for a year.
I mean, it's an upgrade, I suppose, over driving. I think about driving pizzas in the late 70s, early 80s, like that. We're talking pre-GPS world over here. So, like, how did you know where everything was? Did you have to, like, just go around with a paper map, like a land pirate, you know, and a compass to figure out where everybody lived?
We had an oversized map in the store, the delivery area. And, it's getting around Tucson's actually pretty easy. And by the time you're there for a month or so, you pretty much know just about every street. So it was pretty quick. But there were times that you were lost and you would have to find a payphone and call the customer or call the store, which was annoying because, you know, it was a big chunk of your income, that 20 cents to drop in the...
Sure. So, and didn't Domino's have like a 30-minute or it's free guarantee for a while too? I remember like that creating like a NASCAR-like event over there and perhaps even some accidents.
That became a thing later on, but it was always a 30-minute. That was the goal. But the 30-minute or free thing kind of kicked in about a year later, and it was on a limited basis. Yeah, and that was problematic. It absolutely was. And was something to deal with in a big way. Later on, we actually couldn't get insurance. We had to form our own insurance company, and we did a consortium with a bunch of other franchisees. So it was a different time for sure. But so back to the story, what happened is I was offered this $200 a week job and thought, okay, maybe I can buy a house or a duplex, rent out half of it. After the first year, which is what I committed to, I actually owned three houses at that point. I had, you know, bought and fixed up some places and was renting them out. And I was like, well, this isn't so bad. And I had opened up the third store at that point, which was at Davis-Monthan. And, you know, maybe I'll do this another year. Well, that went on for 14 years that I was, oh, maybe I'll just do this for another year. And I eventually left being the president of the company. So, that was the deal at Domino's, and took it from 4 to 400 people. And
I love it. I love stories of people starting from the bottom in the restaurant industry. I feel like so often some of the most successful people in the industry are literally people that started at the entry-level jobs, because then you have an empathy and understanding of what it's like to work of every facet in your business.
Unquestionably. And actually, we made a point during my tenure there of hiring everybody from within the company. Pretty much every manager that worked at that company for the time that I was there started as his driver, except for only one that I can think of. And she was wonderful. I actually still stay in touch with her now, 45 years later. So she's a nutritionist now.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And so when did you go off to open your own first restaurant? Because at some point you leave the Domino's Corporation as like the president of Domino's of Arizona over here, right?
Southern Arizona.
Well,
you know, by the time I left, I was 35 years old and, you know, had been married to a job. And I wound up getting married and having a child. And during that period of time, I kind of wanted to not do much of anything. I'd had too many experiences that a lot of them are unpleasant. You know, I mean, I was on call 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Nothing is more disturbing than getting a phone call from the FBI at 5 o'clock in the morning saying, we needed you to go to the office and pull a file on one of your employees who was kidnapped. That was a lot of fun.
Oh my goodness.
And, you know, had some employees that were killed. I actually was involved in a robbery where I had a 38 shoved up my nose. You know, so there's a lot of things happening when you're in that kind of a business. But I was ready to just kind of disappear and go off the radar. And so I got married, and I was at my house, and I got a phone call from the guy who was our electrician on all the stores that we built. And he called me up, and we used to play golf together, and he was quite a bit older than I. And he called me up, and he said, hey, are you still gainfully fun employed? Which was probably one of the funniest things I ever heard. And I said, well, yeah, I am. And he goes, I said, why? Do you want to play some golf today? And he goes, no, I need some help. And I said, with what? And he goes, I've got too many jobs going on. I need somebody to supervise a project. And I said, well, how do I fit in here? And he said, well, you know, you went to school for electrical engineering, so you probably know more about electricity than most other people. You know, basically asking you to manage people, which is what you've been doing for the last 14 years. And we've built many, many stores. I know you know how to read a set of blueprints. I couldn't really argue with him, so I went to work for him on a temporary basis, and one thing led to another, and I wound up actually being a general contractor for 10 years and, you know, took my engineering background and my background from building stores and built some houses and did some remodels and things like that. So that was a 10-year thing, and then one day I woke up and couldn't move my right arm because my shoulder had locked up. I had torn a rotator cuff, and my doctor said, you know, maybe time to kind of back off on that. And I was like, okay, what do I do next? And that was the time where my wife and I thought it would be a good idea to go back into the restaurant business, as hard as it was. But we had a working partner that was interested in doing something together. And unfortunately, that didn't work out. And I wound up being the working partner.
Story that happens all too often, sir.
Yeah, so, you know, and close to 50 years old, wasn't too excited about that. But, you know, you do what you do in the restaurant business. And, you know, had an 18-year run with it. It was fun, difficult, but it was fun. So,
well, don't go anywhere. We're going to take a quick break over here for CBS News and Matt Neely. But we've got a couple more fun segments with Ward 6 City Council candidate and entrepreneur Jay Tolkoff. You're listening to Grant Kruger on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m., your home for local news and talk. Good morning and welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger, every weekday, 7 to 9 a.m. on The Morning Voice. We're bringing you all kinds of local Tucson talk. On Mondays, you've got Lydia Aranda. On Tuesdays, you've got Ted Maxwell. Well, and from the Southern Arizona Leadership Council with his engagement hours. On Wednesday, you get me, the intersection of restaurants and politics and all things happening in the entertainment and hospitality industry in Southern Arizona. On Thursdays, Tom Moulton from the Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance. Tomorrow, he's got Tim Vettersmith calling in about a number of upcoming festivals and cool things happening. And on Fridays, Dr. Ed Ackerley bringing you wonders from the University of Arizona. We are The Morning Voice. Now, we're joined with it for another segment by City Council Ward 6 candidate and entrepreneur, Mr. Jay Tolkoff. Welcome back, Jay.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, so you were telling us your story about entrepreneurship and getting into your own restaurant, right? You started as a non-working partner and quickly ended up being the working partner, a story oh so common in the restaurant business over here. But I was wondering, you got a kind of a cool radio voice over here, and I'd heard that you maybe had some experience in radio as well.
It's true. I was never the on-air personality, but because of my love for music and my band, we did a lot of diversity. We were playing jazz, rock, fusion when we were 15 years old, and you know, of course, we did pop stuff, and we did a lot of nostalgia kind of stuff in the 70s, and we just got a really big swash of different music. And I always felt that, you know, typical radio was kind of limiting. And in 1983, there was a gem that came on air in Tucson at it was at 91.7 FM called KXCI, and which is now at 91.3. But people don't know this, but KXCI, XCI, actually are the Roman numerals for 91, and that's how they got that those call letters for their frequency.
Back in the day in Phoenix, there was KXIV, which is 1400. They played big band music that my dad liked to listen to, and it was KXIV, which is 14 Roman numeral for 1400. So not uncommon.
So you know, I didn't know that. I kind of feel like it wasn't nearly as significant now. But and anyway, I was doing well in the early '80s. I was no longer making $2.12 an hour, and this was a cause that I supported, and they had an annual membership, which is called the Frequency Club, and you would just donate $91.30 or 70 cents, and yeah, you'd get a year of membership to the Foundation for Creative Broadcasting. So it was early in 86, I went down to the studios, which was on Congress at the time, in the old Dave Blum and Sons building. And they were always talking about their studio, which was antiquated in the attic. And they had done a huge fund drive to create this new studio. And I went down to pay my $91.70. And I said, hey, could I see the studio? And they looked at me like, why would you want to see the studio? I said, well, you know, heard all, you know, all this talk about it. So they take me upstairs to the attic. I go, well, this is the old studio. And they're like, what happened to the new studio that we raised all this money for? And somebody took me downstairs, and there was this partially done facility, which was beautiful. But unfortunately, it wasn't completed. And I was like, what's going on? You know, we've got all this equipment sitting here not being used. And they said, well, we're not going forward with it. And I go, why is that? And they go, because our rent has gone up by a factor of 10. It went from $300 a month to $3,000 a month. And I was like, wait a minute. You decided to build a studio and you had no lease going forward? No. It's like, wow, you people need some skills. So I ran for the board and got on the board of directors. And when I got to the first meeting, the manager of the station came up to me and said, you know, we're so glad we've got somebody with a business background. Was, you know, board was loaded with tons and tons of people. As a matter of fact, a lot of them didn't even know they were on the board. But most of them were programmers and had on-air shows that they were trying to protect their turf. And there isn't really anybody paying attention to the nuts and bolts. So he asked me if I would take a look at maybe restructuring some of the long-term debt. And my thoughts were, geez, you've been on the air less than 3 years. How do you have a lot of long-term debt? Well, as it turned out, they were almost $1 million in debt, and they were losing a lot of money every month. They were bringing in less than half of what they needed to support the outgo. And the station was on the verge of going dark. They were not in compliance with the FCC rules and regulations, and there were all kinds of problems. And I thought one of the biggest problems was that the board of directors was filled with people that didn't even know they were on the board. We had some county supervisors that I called up, and they're like, I don't even know what KXCI is, and they were on the board of directors. So I wound up getting myself into a position where I was elected as the president, and with the goal of doing nothing but putting KXCI on a firm footing to be able to go forward, because it was the only station where they didn't have a playlist. They could just do whatever they wanted.
Pretty cool, right? So basically, you not only helped build Domino's up from a 4-person to a 400-person company, you saved a local radio station.
I've been accused of that, yeah.
Wild. Sure. That's an amazing story. What a great, like, you know, backstory for your career. Now, we were into the restaurant with you, right? PJ's. Give me the breakdown of this one. It was on Speedway at first, right?
Yeah. We actually partnered originally with East Coast Super Subs and went into that store on Speedway. And the guy who owned East Coast Super Subs, a terrific guy. I still talk to him on a regular basis today. He had gotten himself into some trouble. He had another location, and there was a fire, and their insurance wasn't adequate to take care of everything, and he was in trouble financially, and so he came to me and asked me to get involved with it. And you know, I said, yeah, this looks like a good idea. There was another location up in Phoenix, and now, long story short, my then wife, she was not real happy with the way our relationship was going, let's just put it that way, and she decided that we needed to be on our own. And I was like, well, you know, we're not that young anymore, you know, taking over a restaurant on our own. And she said, oh, it'll be fine. And, you know, and it was difficult. I'll say that. It was a lot of fun, but, you know, when you're in the sandwich industry and you're up against, you know, the giants like Subway and
sure,
Jimmy John's.
Big chains. The sandwich industry is a very difficult sector of the restaurant business for our listeners out there. You're listening to Jay Tolkoff, entrepreneur and candidate for City Council Ward 6 coming up in November. The sandwich business is hard. I mean, you've got meat and cheese, both of which are expensive, no?
Oh, yeah. and a lot more expensive than it used to be. We just really had one goal, and it was to sell, to sell great food with good service at a reasonable price. And I think we did that. I mean, to this day, I run into people on the street, and it's like, aren't you Jay? It's like, what? I can't find a good sandwich in the Hound anymore. And, there's always that draw to go back to it. You never know. I might actually open up another place sometime. And just so that I can spend money on things that I could spend otherwise. But it's, there's something about the restaurant business. It gets into your blood, and, even though every day, at the end of the day, you have a mess that you have to clean up, and you open up the next day with a nice, clean restaurant. At the end of the day, there's a mess to clean up. There's some draw about, having people come in and enjoying your food. It's something special about that industry.
Without a doubt. And so you not only live in Ward 6, obviously to run as a candidate, there's a residency requirement, but your operations, your businesses were also in Ward 6. You really have this like neat sort of duality where you've been both a resident and experienced city services, but also a business owner as well, too, because you end up moving that shop to 6th Avenue in Tucson, correct?
6th Street, yeah.
6th Street in Tucson, sorry.
Yeah, right in the heart of Sam Hughes. We were in an old gas station that had a lot of history. It'd been there for years and years and years, and it was a difficult building with little parking. And unfortunately, I actually partnered with the guy who owned Nimbus Brewing Company, now defunct Nimbus Brewing Company.
Jim Counts,
yeah. And he wound up, how do I say this? He kind of embezzled a lot of money from me.
There could be a whole podcast, I think, about Nimbus Brewing and even like the history of brewing in Tucson, an equally difficult business. I mean, you're taking sandwiches, which is a hard sector of the restaurant business, and then brewing, an equally, if not more difficult sector of the restaurant business, and combining them. And those are pretty tough.
Well, when you add alcohol to the mix, it does get difficult. And I knew plenty about the customer side of being in a bar, but really didn't know much about that other side. But that was a whole learning curve too. And we definitely had our following, and it was never really had the problems that most bars do. I only had to throw two people out for fighting in a lot of years.
That's a pretty good ratio over there. Let's take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk about Ward 6 with Jake Tolkoff over here, entrepreneur, candidate for City Council Ward 6. We're going to talk about what gave you the drive, what gave you the idea to run for Tucson City Council. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to The Morning Voice on 10:30 a.m. Your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. Thank you for spending part of your Wednesday morning with us. We've got Jay Tolkoff here in studio. Jay is a candidate for the City Council Ward 6 and serial entrepreneur. He was breaking down his opening of a restaurant at 6th Street in Tucson, a tough corner right now for the hospitality industry as well too, huh Jay? Like with the changeover of Flores Market and whatnot as well too, and Rincon Market closing.
I have to say I don't pay attention to that kind of stuff. When I move on, I move on. And I think I've been in my old business once, and I think I've been to that corner twice in the 3+ years that we've been closed down. But I didn't realize that Flores Run had turned over. I knew that they were changing their format, but I didn't really get into why.
The market business seems to be a pretty tough category over there. And this is coming from a couple restaurateurs sitting across from each other talking about how hard a business can be. If we say it's tough, it's really tough out there, listeners, right? Like, and that market business is one that I don't think can be done by a sole proprietorship anymore without ties to a bigger supermarket chain in just some capacity. There's no way to compete. And I think there was a lot of problems too in the operator side from a union perspective. You get the grocers and baggers and things like that unionize, and that creates some challenges for a local restaurant group that might not be capacitated to handle those sort of things. So you kept the T6 filling station was open up until COVID at some point?
Yeah, we stayed open during COVID under the promise that the federal government was going to bail us out for all our losses, and I lost a lot of money during that period of time. I also had moved my 99-year-old mother in with me. She lived in New Jersey in the house I grew up with in for 60 years that she was there. And she got to the point where she couldn't take care of herself, so I moved her in with me. And at 99 years old, she had a heart valve replacement that I navigated while running a restaurant.
Wow, that's no easy feat. But what a noble thing, Jay, because ultimately that's the greatest gift you could give back to your parents, right? People that raised you and changed your diapers, and, you know, decades later, you've got to repay that favor to your family. So it's a really, really noble thing.
You know, I will say it was a great time. As difficult as it was, I got to know my mother in ways. You know, I mean, I left home when I was 20, and now I'm in my 60s. She's in her 90s, and I got to know her some ways that you wouldn't want to get to know your parent. But it was a terrific time. But it was difficult because, you know, I was running the restaurant, and, you know, I had to have people watching her. At a certain point, I couldn't really leave her alone anymore, and. She made it just shy of 103. So, you know, during COVID, you know, she turned 100 on St. Patrick's Day of 2020, which was the day everything
COVID-iversary, of course. We've talked about that one over here. Yeah. Just over 5 years ago to the day, almost 5 years and a month at this point.
Yeah. And we were out at the La Quinta Resort out in California. I have a bunch of family out there, and we were, out of the 600 some odd rooms they had there, we were one of the five rooms or something that was occupied, and everything was closed, and it was an interesting way to celebrate your 100th birthday. But the COVID, basically what happened with COVID was, lost a lot of money, and we were doing fine until the city decided to institute that curfew, and we dropped our sales about 80% overnight, and we decided to shut down for 6 weeks, and then we brought it back together again, and it was just too hard to bring that business back in. And Mom was starting to really decline, and I had other things to do, and I just finally decided that when I wound up getting nothing from the restaurant revitalization fund.
As most people didn't, that was a particularly challenged fund over there, the way they changed the rules at the beginning of the Biden administration with that one.
Yeah, so I wound up getting nothing out of the $186,000 they said that they were going to give us, which would have taken care of all the problems and given me the seed money to kind of rebuild it. And we also went through the period of minimum wage hikes they hit the restaurant industry really, really hard, because when I opened up in the early 2000s, minimum wage was, I think, 5 1/4 an hour, and you were allowed to offset tipped employees to the tune of $3 an hour. Well, when minimum wage went to $13, $14, it was still that $3 an hour. So what was happening is you had to give all this money to the servers who were already making $30, $40 an hour in tips, and basically take it away from the cooks. And so it made it really, really difficult, and which is one of the reasons that I think that restaurant prices have spiked so much, is they never took that into consideration when they came up with those new regulations.
Without a doubt. I mean, a very poignant point over here, and something that I worked very hard to try to change with a ballot initiative last year, unsuccessfully, of course, too, because it's such a difficult elevator pitch. Most people don't really understand how the compensation model works in restaurants, with every state having different wage structure, every municipality having a different wage structure. People just don't, quite frankly, understand and don't get what it costs to run a full service establishment these days.
I think that's an understatement. You know, I don't think they just don't understand. They don't want to know. You come up with an initiative that says, we're going to cut the pay of these people that work in a restaurant, and it just sounds terrible, and it's really got nothing to do with their total compensation package. I mean, my servers were very happy with the money that they made, as most are.
A complicated situation indeed. Well, don't go anywhere. Stick around for another segment. We're going to finish up your story over here with Jay Tolkoff and what gave him the drive to run for City Council Ward 6. No easy feat over there in the city of Tucson, for sure. More restaurants and politics talk coming up at the top of the hour. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Krueger and Jay Tolkoff on 1030 AM The Voice, your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Krueger. We've got Jay Tolkoff still in studio with us over here. Jay's a serial entrepreneur. He helped build the Domino's of Southern Arizona up from 4 to 400 employees, was the president of the board of KXEI, the owner of PJ's Subs, and we're talking all things restaurant business. Welcome back, Jay.
Thanks.
Hey, so you were giving us the rundown about the challenges of being in Midtown, City of Tucson, 6th Street and Tucson over there. Break down some of the challenges you had as a business owner.
Well, you know, it's a corridor to the university, and, you know, traffic was always a thing. It always seemed like any time that there was a collision at that intersection that all the cars and the police would gather in my six space parking lot, so that was always fun. There was the Rincon Market fire, which changed that corner dramatically. The fire department did their hydration staging in our parking lot, which was fine, you know. But, you know, it's just a small amount of area, a lot of congestion. It was hard to get in and out of it, without a doubt. And probably one of the things that made me go, gosh, you know, we should be doing things differently here was, I think it was in 2014, they decided to resurface 6th Street between Campbell and Country Club. And this was not just, you know, put down a layer of new surface. They actually took the roadbed down, I think, 8 inches, and it was supposed to be a 2-week project, and they milled it down, and they were moving along with a very good clip. I mean, I was amazed at how fast that first pour went down of the first 4 inches of asphalt, and then it just stopped, and it was like, what's going on? And, you know, the workers would come into the place and get sandwiches or drinks and whatnot, so I had a relationship with them. And it turned out that they had had a problem with the test samples. They have to pull core samples out of the roadbed to make sure that it complies with the different governmental regulations for, you know, compression and various other statistics that we don't need to talk about. And it wasn't passing. And so the road just sat there with all these cones down it, with one lane in each direction. There was about a 4-inch drop-off going in and out of my parking lot, which most people didn't want to challenge.
Risk their automobile, of course,
yeah.
Right?
And sales took a dramatic turn. And as you know, when it comes to eating out, people get very habitual about the places they go to. And, you know, there was just many, many months where it was really difficult to get in and out of my place. As a matter of fact, sometimes I couldn't get to work without having to drive through an alley. And and it's like, you know, this shouldn't be. And then it was in August, and all of a sudden they painted. They put the lines down the road and took all the cones away. And even though the roadway wasn't completed, traffic was flowing back to normal. It's like, well, this is great. And it turned out the reason they did it was because there was a U of A football game coming up, and they needed to move lots of cars. So they had the two U of A football games, and the cones came back, and we had all the problems again. And as I said, you know, people just started going to other places. And eventually, apparently, according to one of the supervisors, they found enough core samples that passed, and they did put down the last amount of asphalt and brought it up to grade. But by that time, you know, like 3 months had gone by, and it was really devastating to the business. And, you know, I wasn't the only one that was affected by it. There was, you know, there were the market across the street, other little shops along there. We all went through the same thing. And unfortunately, in the restaurant business, it's a lot harder to get those habitual people back rather than, say, a barber shop or something like that. You know, cause,
sure, there's a lot of competition out there.
Yeah.
And you can't just have these massive, opens and closes, shutdowns. As you talked about before the break, the idea that you could open again, close again, and then restart this machine. A restaurant isn't a light switch that can just be turned on and off. It's a complex business organism that requires dozens, if not hundreds, in some cases, employees to be trained and to work in unison and to really figure this thing out. If you start having extreme business cycles of really busy and then really slow and really busy and really slow, or on again, off again, it just goes backwards and you lose a lot of staff pretty quickly.
Oh, you do. And I mean, it's, it used to be, when I was a kid growing up that, people would go out and they'd get a job and they'd stay out of business for years and years and years, and then they get a pension and they'd retire and all that. And that whole dynamic has completely changed. And I got to say that a lot of it has to do with corporate America. They're not really loyal to their employees anymore, and employees aren't really loyal back. It's like, where's the grass and the greenest right now? And, just because I've worked there for 10 years doesn't really mean that I need to stay there. Somebody's offering me better opportunities with more exciting jobs, something that sounds more fun or something that's going to, pay better. There's all kinds of things. So, in my tenure here, I employed a little over 10,000 people, and for the most part, most of them I run into, and we have good memories and things like that. But the reality is they all moved on, and rightfully so, because at some point we didn't have a business to operate or anymore, or they got their degree, So when you say that you can't just flip a light switch, there's a lot of inertia. It's like trying to get a train to stop on a dime. You can't do it. There's a lot of moving parts, and to get it started again is really difficult. And I have to say that, when I got to be in my 60s, it was like, do I really want to start this up again? And my son had no interest in being in the business. What am I doing it for?
Understood. I keep my daughters out of the business as well, too, because it's such a grind,
Dad.
Thank you. So at what point, with all this entrepreneurship and leadership experience, at what point do you say, I want to throw my hat into the ring of politics? What drives you to want to run for city council?
Well, as I said, I moved here for what was going to be a two-year stint, and I liked it so much that I decided that this was going to be home. Very different from, the outside of New York where I grew up. The reality is that I can't say that Tucson has really thrived in the last few decades. People come and visit, and I have to make excuses for the roads. I have to make excuses for the trash. I have to, the parks overrun with, tents and things of that. People go, what the hell is going on here? And, it didn't used to be like that. And I don't think it needs to be like that. The other thing is, I live in Midtown, and as a restaurant owner, and, my son had moved down on, and I was a single guy living in a house that, I've lived in since 1989. And, according to the Tucson police, it's the most burglarized occupied house in Tucson. There was a two-week stretch where my house was broken into eight times.
Eight times in 2 weeks, yeah. Jay? That's insane.
Yeah, three times in one day. The third time when the police came back, your place gets broken into three times in one day. The police actually kind of pay attention to you. And this lieutenant for the burglary division called me, and I said, what am I supposed to do here? This is ridiculous. And it wasn't, it was really a function of people that were desperate. When people are breaking into your house and stealing things like toilet paper and forks and knives and flashlights, this is just not your typical burglary ring. These people are actually looking for stuff to survive. They stole my clothes. It just went on and on and on, and nobody seemed to be able to do anything about it. As a matter of fact, they told me to get an armed guard, which I did, which really kind of, that was where we got things under control, was when two guys broke in and the armed guard actually drew a weapon. That
My
was
goodness.
Interesting.
But this is the crime tax that we talk about so often, right? These taxes that fall upon the citizens and the business owners in the city of Tucson for our lack of enforcement of laws that are already on the books right now, too.
Yeah. That is really kind of where the rubber meets the road. I was thinking about this. You know, I was talking to somebody about some of the problems with the homeless and things of that nature, and they said, "Well, you know, don't you care about those people?" And I said, "Well, yeah, of course I care about those people, but I want to ask you, don't you care about the people that actually go to work and are raising their families and have a job and are, you know, and their world is being destroyed because of this other group of people that, you know, we all care about? Why did we stop caring about the people that actually pay the taxes and keep things going? We don't seem to really care about them." And you talk about the crime tax. I mean, my insurance rates they've exploded, not just in my car, but my house. And, you know, our taxes keep going up. And this is all a function of the fact that we're really not taking care of business. And that's my big thing is, you know, I got to the point where I thought, you know, I don't like living here anymore. And I thought about, you know, selling off my house and some other properties that I have and just picking up and moving. I actually was looking at Aravaca. There's a restaurant there called La Gitana that I thought about buying. And you know, then I started thinking, you know, at my age, do I really want to pick up and start over someplace new? And I thought, you know, it'd be much better to use the experience and the knowledge that I have in business and nonprofits and whatnot, and try to apply it to the way the government runs. A little common sense could go a long way in this town.
Without a doubt. Well, let's take that moment to take another break. We got one more segment with Jay Tolkoff, serial entrepreneur and candidate for City Council Ward 6, coming up after the break. Speaking of a man of wealth and taste over here, we're joined by Jay Tolkoff on The Morning Voice. Jay is both a serial entrepreneur and candidate for City Council Ward 6. So we were talking about the why. Like, why would somebody that's been successful in business and life choose to run for city politics in the city of Tucson, right? That's a pretty tough nut over there. We elect a lot of social justice activists more than business people, more than people with organizational skill sets. What do you think about that?
Well, in the 8 weeks since I decided to run, I've done a lot of research, and you're spot on. I think that we have a lot of really well-intentioned people that are running our city politics, but I'm just not that impressed with their skill sets. That may sound arrogant, but at some point or another, we develop roadmaps and strategies and you know to get things done. But at some point or another, you got to get in your car and drive to get to the goal. And I'm not sure that the people that are actually sitting in the positions of power and the decision making have those skills. I mean, if you look at their resumes, you might see a lot of people that were community organizers or activists, and that's all necessary. But at some point or another, you need to have somebody that actually can go out there and hammer a nail and build an organization and get from point A to point B and just get it done. And I believe that my background and the things that I've done actually highly qualify me to be somebody that can help get out there and fix Tucson. Tucson needs to be fixed. It is very broken right now. There are all kinds of statistics economically that support that. When we talk about, people talk about that there's not a really good labor pool here, that we just don't have a very skilled workforce. Well, we actually have a tremendous resource in the University of Arizona that graduates 8,000 people every year, and most of them pick up and move someplace else because there aren't any opportunities here. There are plenty of opportunities in Phoenix, but they're not here.
Without a doubt, we've done entire shows here on The Morning Voice about that very topic right there, sir.
And, you know, there's no particular reason. When I moved here, IBM was a huge factor. It spurred a lot of growth, and I know there are people that like to keep this as the old Pueblo and kind of restrict growth, but, you know, the population is growing, and it's going to continue to grow. And you might not want that to happen, but you're not going to stop it. IBM is gone. Burr Brown is gone. Texas Instrument is gone. And I think that a lot of times when, you know, companies come in and look at what's going on in Tucson, you know, hey, let's move a new organization to Tucson. They get it, you know, their decision makers get out at the airport and get on Alvernon Road to, you know, head into town, and their teeth are literally rattling out of their mouths because of the potholes and things. This is just, it's really inexcusable. Roads are something we've all paid for. We've paid for them over the year, and we're not getting them. And, you know, the current city council and previous ones for the last 20 years are constantly asking for tax increases. You know, we have a garbage tax that we didn't have 20 years ago. Water rates are continually going up. They're just looking at, you know, raising the rates to the county again.
Of course, differential water rates are going to be a hot topic this year for sure.
And the reality is, you know, you brought up the special election thing. You know, yeah, we've got all these special elections that are, you know, the $1.1 million is what TEP paid for that failed proposition special election a couple years ago. But we constantly do this. And, you know, it's disturbing to me that we had to have a special election for 414 a mere few months after we had a general election. And the only reason for it was just to kind of subvert the democratic process. We wanted to have lower turnout because they thought they had a better chance of getting this tax increase through. And fortunately, I think the people of Tucson keep speaking the same thing, that we've been taxed enough.
The people of Tucson saw right through that one, Jay. I mean, that was a 70% to 30%. You know, that was a mandate by any standard over there.
And, you know, and it's time, you know, the Arizona Constitution, Article 2, basically says that the people in power are put there to protect the rights and the interests of the constituents. And we just, as a city, we just don't seem to be doing that. We don't seem to be listening to the people that are actually out there making Tucson work. We're listening to a very vocal minority. And as a result, there are problems that, you know, they're endemic. They're challenging. There's no question about it. You know, we need to look at our fiscal responsibility. You know, to spend $1.1 million on an election and to say, well, we need that because we don't have enough money, and then, you know, when one of the council people's asked on air how much did that special election cost, and this person voted for it, he goes, I don't know. That's not something I need to know. Well, how is it that you don't need to know how much it costs to do something? This is our money that you're responsible for.
Without a doubt, Jay. Well, speaking of elections over here, you are the Republican candidate for Ward 6. The signature deadline was Monday, April 7th, and you submitted enough signatures to be on that ballot. You're running uncontested, it looks like, over here. So you don't really have to participate in that primary on August 5th, and that will take you all the way to the city council election on November 4th, 2025. There are four Democrats lined up that got enough signatures right now to challenge that one. So they're going to have a somewhat contemptuous Democrat primary. That's a loaded field over there. And the winner gets you in early November, correct?
Well, I guess they'll be, you know, against me. I don't know if they get me. Although I did have one of the – I've met with one over the phone and one in person with some of the Democrat people. And one of them actually asked me if they prevail, if I would be willing to help them out on their staff. There's some good people that are running as Democrats. There's no question about it. You know, we just need to see who actually is going to be running against me. I know that of the two people that I talk with, that I would be comfortable with either one of them being on the city council, that they're both really knowledgeable and their hearts are in the right place. So it's just the same thing with me. Is, you know, people go, why are you doing this? You know, I mean, are you out of your mind? And I'm doing it for all the right reasons. You know, I've had people say, oh, well, the pay's pretty good now. I'm not doing this for the money. I'm doing this because I want to fix my town. This is my home. And, you know, it's a home. It's the home to at least 500,000 people. And, you know, I get out there and talk to people, and people are unhappy. they don't like what's going on, and we need some serious change.
Without a doubt. So there aren't a lot of change agents coming, however. Ward 5, as we talked about over here, doesn't even have a Republican challenger. And so that particular seat will be decided by the Democrat primary on August 5th. And Ward 3 has a Republican challenger in Janet Wittenbraker, right? She ran for mayor of Tucson. She's also run for Pima County Board of Supervisors. And so she's thrown her hat in for Ward 3. But we're going to have a couple new city council people no matter what, because with Fimbres retiring mm-hmm. in 5, that mm-hmm. crowded field will create a new city council person, and Ward 6 is going to be somebody new as well too.
Well, you know, I'm running as a Republican because there was no way to run as a Democrat. You know, there were too many people that were really embedded with the party, but the reality is I really think Republican and Democrat doesn't matter on a local level. We're the last city in Arizona that has partisans election on a city level, and for good reason, because all of our interests are common. When you're talking about local politics, issues like abortion or gun rights, they don't even enter into the equation. You know, we're really talking about core services, roads, safety, you know, being comfortable in your house or your business.
All music to our listeners' ears over here. Well, Jay, I appreciate you coming and taking part of your Wednesday morning and discussing your race with our listeners over here. Anything else you want to say to listeners right now, Mr. Tolkoff?
No, I mean, I just really enjoyed chatting with you, just not just at the restaurant, but here. And thanks for the opportunity to let me get on the air with you.
Is there a website or a Facebook page or anywhere where the listeners can get to know a little bit more about you, Jay?
God, you had to do that, didn't you?
Well, actually, coming soon. That's okay.
We got a strategy meeting coming up on Tuesday to start building that organization.
All right.
Looking forward to hearing more. Jay Tolkoff, entrepreneur and a candidate for Ward 6, Tucson City Council. Don't go anywhere. We got more local restaurant news coming up after the break.
Thanks, Grant.
Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. We always love to bring you local restaurant openings and closings and cool things happening over here in the Old Pueblo. As we talked about last week, the District Bites and Brews is opening up this week on Campbell in the former location that was Pastiche. I happened to see Shamrock food trucks parked in front of it yesterday as I was driving my way to work over at River in Campbell. So that leads me to believe that they are close, right? You're not taking big drops of food if you're not ready to open up. So this one is
those
coming.
Perishables they yes. need to be sold.
But my understanding is inside information says Monday is their first day.
Okay. Because
they're clearly hurrying up to try to catch some semblance of restaurant season, right? That window is closing
pretty quickly. You have educated KVOI listeners on the fact that through graduation and Mother's Day, then things get kind of
okay, they get sparse. A lot lighter after that. So any semblance of restaurant season you could catch could be helpful. Now, it's tough to open up right before this big spike that happens in early May, too, because your first couple weeks of business are absolute go time with all these graduations as well, too. So you get success financially. The cash registers ring. But is it success operationally? Did you take care of all those people really well when you get hit that hard on an opening?
Right.
I always love to try to open up restaurants in, say, August, right? Where you've got like a slow month or two before October. You get 6 or 8 weeks to get your game together. Like, that's the perfect world to do this. But nobody gets that choice. Even chain restaurants often drag behind months behind their original planning for many reasons outside of their control. It's all the permits. It's all the trade stacking, each one independent, you know, but dependent on each other's performance that you can't control. And if even one car in that train slows up, the caboose, which is your general, you know, your grand opening, gets delayed and delayed and delayed. Another big opening that's happening up on Campbell is going to be 3105 North Campbell Avenue, and that's the site of the former Fabrics and Go store that got completely demolished. It was bought by Larson Baker.
I know it's
and
coming
absolutely
up on this
bladed
one.
That is going to be a Shake Shack as the Shake Shack vacation of America continues. And I watched this one with an odd curiosity here, because The Shake Shack concept was founded in Madison Square Park in New York, right? In Manhattan, as literally a shack. Mm-hmm. It was a hamburger and fries shack done by restaurateur Danny Meyer. Danny is one of the most noted, famous, like, restaurateurs in the entire United States, having brought us Union Square Cafe, Gramercy Tavern, 11 Madison Park, Tabla, all these fantastic, fantastic restaurants, right? This is like a Michelin award-winning kind of guy who's actually chosen to go this QSR model, this quick service burger concept, because in the face of rising minimum wage, Shake Shack is actually more profitable than running white tablecloth fine dining. And from that one restaurant 15 years ago, one little shack in Madison Square Park, they now have 378 locations, man. 378 across the country. I mean, this is a growing monster of a place with three more openings in the state of Arizona.
Need a few dairies to support that for all those shows.
Yes, I think this will bring their total of, once this Tucson one comes, of 9 restaurants in Arizona right now. And you're seeing people with this much experience choosing to build QSR restaurants as opposed to full service fine dining, even though that was their specialty, because there's just no money in it anymore. It's so difficult to be profitable in any capacity. What's going to open up as well, too, in a couple months is Miramonte at the Rancho Shopping Center. This is where the Whole Foods is on Speedway. And this concept is brought to you, and I've got only limited information. I've got the name over here, but this is Deborah Tonino and Nick Kreutz from Contigo and Locale fame as well, too. And Locale is a really well-regarded concept at Broadway and Alvernon. And, of course, Contigo is located in La Paloma in its second iteration. It was originally at River and Campbell for many years. And these guys are great restaurateurs. So I'm really excited for a Midtown location to open up for them. This has been a completely redone shopping center, bought as well by Larson Baker, and the tenant improvement has been done by Rep and McLean Construction. We've had Paige Rep on this show before talking about Dusk Music Festival and the concerts with the Conquistadors. And so he's a real construction, you know, guru, and has been building out this rebranded and refaced shopping center for about 5 months now. And Miramonte looks to be about 2 months or so out there, but it is coming. As well, too, the Roadies concept, right, is now open for business. This was the one that was attached to the Roadhouse Cinema as well, too. So this is an experiential gastro pub type concept with games, right? It's got arcade games and axe throwing and bowling and whatnot, adding to the already entertainment that was the Roadhouse, right? Like a full service dinner theater type thing, which is pretty well executed. I went last week, right? We took our 9-year-old to the Minecraft movie, which wasn't exactly on my top of my list to see over there, but it was pretty cute and actually done for adults as well, too. There's lots of 80s and early 90s humor and music in there, like tuned perfectly for the adult bringing their child to this movie. It never ceases to amaze me how they're able to put that together and know your demographic.
And our group. Brendan's going to be there soon.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So Roadhouse is doing a great job over there, and they've expanded into the old Bed Bath & Beyond location and created this Roadies. It had its soft opening last week. It is open for business this week, and so we're wishing them a tremendous amount of success, because they've clearly taken a big bite of the apple over here. I mean, that is an awful lot of square footage that they're renting over there for that location. So as well, what's going to open up in St. Philip's Plaza is a new Pure Love Juice. If you happen to take note of Pure Love Juice, which has been 1980 East River Road, that's the 2-story building that Body Works Pilates is in. It used to be the Breckenridge Brewery and River Road Brewery back in the
day. Your old stomping grounds,
yes,
Grant.
Yes, a 10,000 square foot 2-story restaurant. Shocking that that's not in business anymore, right? But right. Like we talk about, these are big, big locations. It was just too big to be supported. So Pure Love Juice opened up as a tiny couple hundred square foot little juice bar with just a couple little tables outside, but they've been there for nearly a decade at this point. I want to say they're on year 8 and some change. And they're going to move into the center courtyard of St. Philip's Plaza, moving into the former space that was the Wren Bakery and 8 Degrees ice cream shop over here. And they're going to bring an expanded menu, expanded coffee concept, and have a little bit of adjacency to our stage area over there in St. Philip's Plaza, which I think is a pretty neat opportunity for them to grow out of this location that was so small, it didn't even really have any interior seating for customers and no bathroom, and realize their dream into a much bigger location and much better location. And that should be opening up in just a few weeks as well, too. That they're down to the final bits of paint and waiting on health department inspections as well, too. You never know how that stuff is going to go. But there are days like high single digits, you know, low double digit days away right now from opening up a full sit down Pure Love Juice in St. Philip's Plaza. And of course, the Wren Bakery has opened up, as we talked about a few weeks ago, Bakery by Wren, on the opposite side of the plaza. And so wishing Lisa a tremendous amount of success. That one already looks incredibly busy with the cycling community because they can come right in off sure. the loop. There's plenty of places to park their bikes. And so a lot of cool things happening on Campbell is it just continues to be Restaurant Row. The former EG's location on Campbell is going to turn into a Jeremiah's Italian Ice and Tropical Smoothie Cafe. It's currently under construction right now. And so I'm sort of watching that one. There seems to be an awful lot of Jeremiah's Italian Ice and Tropical Smoothie Cafe combo is popping up around town. Grant Road just got one as well, too. I'm wondering, like, if this one's got some legs, if there's enough money in smoothies to support, sure. you know, a 2,000 or 3,000 square foot standalone building like that. In something like smoothies, I'm not so sure that there is, but that one also is coming on Campbell, which just continues to become Tucson's Restaurant Row.
It does.
As more and more food service continues to operate. As well, in the food news, there's been a couple of bills that made their way to Governor Hobbs, right? House Bill 2164 was vetoed yesterday. This was a bill that would have disallowed SNAP like to be used for the purchase of high fructose corn syrup okay. beverages. It passed through the House and Senate on pure partisan levels, right? Like all the Republicans voting for, all the Democrats voting against. Restaurateurs actually struggled with this one because if you can't, you can use SNAP in certain types of restaurants, fast food and these sort of things, but we don't really know whether a customer purchases a soda or not. Often if you go to a McDonald's, a Taco Bell, they don't technically sell you a soda, they sell you a cup. And the way this law was written, the carbonated part of the beverage mm-hmm. is what determined soda. Mm-hmm. So you could get a Gatorade, no big deal, right? A Powerade in an unearthly blue color, you know, filled with Mountain Berry Blast, right? Made with real bits of Mountain Berry, I'm sure.
And containing the chemicals that was the dyes that were in the other bill that they signed, that Hobbs signed last week about certain foods in the schools.
And so that was House Bill 2165, yeah. which passed pretty much unanimously through the House and Senate with bipartisan support and was signed by the governor to keep those sort of products out of school meals. But the SNAP one drew a little bit of ire from Governor Hobbs over there, and she's not going to break last year's veto record by any means, but she used her executive powers to bite back at the Republican Party on this particular limitation of using SNAP benefits for soda. And it all kind of ties into part of this Make America Healthy thing that we see going on, and RFK Jr. happened to be in Arizona last week stumping mm-hmm. for these particular bills. And so that one got beaten back, and we're going to have to watch that one in the restaurant business moving forward as we start to move away from high fructose corn syrup products. This isn't the only thing we can and should sell for cold beverages anymore, right? We've growing up in a world where kids are so used to customized cold beverages. Here's my fancy Starbucks pink drink, no classic, minus this, two pumps of that, you know, plus minus this. And they get it the way they want through the app. And then you go to a restaurant. And what do we have? I have ye old, you know, Coca-Cola or Coke Pepsi Sprite. Products and maybe a flavor of iced tea or two.
Right.
And that's it in a world where people are used to customized beverages. And so I'm really going to watch the potential limitations of high fructose corn syrup products like very heavily. And we as an industry need to think better about customized cold beverages for our guests who are getting more and more used to that. We're going to take a quick break. We got one more segment around. Restaurant news coming up after the break. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to 10:30 a.m. The Voice, your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to the final segment of The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger, bringing you all kinds of neat restaurant news and openings and closings and just events happening in the old Pueblo. You know, this little bit of April is actually a slow dip for us in the restaurant business because of so many outdoor events. For example, sure. If you own the Maverick, what happens during Country Thunder, right? When every country fan in the, you know, southern Arizona, in central Arizona descends upon Florence for a four-day drinking and camping fest over there. Not exactly the highest of high seasons for a place like the Maverick. And as well, everybody plans all of their outside events in the months of late October and late April, very specifically because you're not necessarily going to get the bad weather that might happen in February and March. It's just a mixed bag where you kind of know what you're going to get in late April. And so we've got the Pima County Fair coming up starting tomorrow, right? Steve Aoki in concert, actually. We've had Steve Aoki play the Rito Downs before as part of Dusk Music Festival. He's going to open up the fairgrounds for a 10-day stint to the Pima County Fair from the 17th to the 27th. And just in case there wasn't other interesting things going on at that particular time, on the April 26th, the Centurions do their big event, and they've got Canadian rockers, the Bare Naked Ladies coming, and Yachtly Crew.
Yachtly Crew.
And if you guys haven't had a chance to see Yachtly Crew and their take on yacht rock, like, this is a really, really fun band. Think like five guys dressed up like the skipper in Gilligan's Island, you know, white pants, blue blazer, gold buttons, you know, like super, super fun.
Epaulettes, the whole bit.
Yes, you know, all of the above. Yeah. So this is a really, really great band to check out. And Matt, you had a couple bits of restaurant news.
Well, yeah, not the groundbreaking stuff that you bring us, but a couple of things. First of all, the sign is up for Ed Irving's Slice and Ice. Now, they're not open, but it's at Tancredi and Camino Principal. So obviously, when he sold EG's, he probably kept ownership of some of those buildings, which have one by one closed. So he has a prime property to open up his Slice and Ice concept.
Super cool. The OG owner of EG's over there.
Absolutely. The founder, the E in EG's, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So looking forward to that. And in addition to Italian ices, kind of slushy things, and great sandwiches, they'll be doing pizzas, right? Thus the Slice. He's on Grant Road, right near the freeway. So I don't know exactly which, on West Grant Road. He's got his original one there, and he's going to be opening this one near Camino Principal. And like I said, I can see a lot of construction activity there. Getting back to your thing about all the stacking the trades and the caboose being the, we're now open. But the sign, the tall sign, he has his logo in the sign. The other one is Ziggy's, which was Fire Truck Brewing, which was before that Sentinel Peak, and that was sold over at Tancredi and Catalina Highway.
Catalina Highway, yes.
So it was sold, he sold that location to the people from Jeff's Pub. It was called Ziggy's. The sign now says The Ranch. It's going to be kind of a steakhouse kind of concept. And CJ Ham, our friend CJ Ham, will be associated with that as they are going through their transformation. So now there will be a couple of sit-down restaurants at that intersection.
Which is super cool and a great landing spot for CJ over there, who I thought had a great concept in Ham Bones, right, and good food, but a tough location. And as we talk about so often, in the restaurant business, a lot of times your success or failure is dictated by the real estate deal that you forge so early on in your choice, because once you've set up your roots and built it, it's not so easy just to pick up and move across the street. You sign a bad lease or buy the wrong building, you might have doomed yourself in perpetuity to have trouble. It might not happen in 30 days or even a year, but like over a 5 or 10 year period in the marathon that is the business, because it is truly a marathon and not a sprint, that wrong location will set you back over and over again. So I love seeing cool new things happening on Tancredi. We're always talking about ways trying to make Tancredi great again. I know that there's been some rough spots in that area. They just set the bus stop on fire, actually in front of where the Cow Pony was last week. It pretty much burned to the ground.
I did not know that.
I don't know how you burn a bus stop to the ground, but somehow we have achieved
that. We figured it out. Going Tuesday. In Tucson, we innovate, baby.
Yes, without a doubt. We have a special skill set over here, and hopefully that's not it. Hopefully we'll have more and more restaurant openings to talk about rather than restaurant closings. But as we get to this end of season over here, I always fear that like first Monday at the very end of May is sort of Black Monday, in the same way that there's a Black Monday at the end of the NFL season, right? And all the coaches get fired at the end of the season. That's when a lot of restaurants will give up the ghost at that moment too, because if you haven't made money from October to the end of May. Quite frankly, June, July, and August, not looking so great for you either over there. But I'm excited to bring us lots more openings over here, ways for us to build on the best Mexican food in America and the best town to be in. Thank you for spending part of your Wednesday with us over here on The Morning Voice. Don't go anywhere. We've got Kathleen Wynn coming up after the break. Tom Moulton tomorrow on The Morning Voice. It has been a pleasure to spend the day with you on 10:30 a.m. You're home for local news and talk.